Welcome to the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. Show notes can be found at www.robnunphoto.com. That's www.robnunphoto.com. SEL is proud to be sponsored by Mosey Pro and GoToMeeting. Now, on with the show. Hi and welcome to SCL, the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. My name's Rob from robnunphoto.com and this is my little audio diary about my journey through the wonderful world of photography. Hope everybody's had a great week. It's actually been pretty cold for once down here in Gosport on the south coast of the UK. We had a little bit of snow on the surrounding countryside, but nothing actually came down here. And a little bit of frost on the car. I'd imagine lots of you out there in podcast land are having much worse weather than we have, but still felt a little bit cold going to work. And, had to have the heating on full blast, so the only real photography I've done this week was a little bit of macro photography, where I set up my old Hammer tripod, put my 350D on it, and used the 55 to 250 IS lens with the IS turned off, obviously, because it was on a tripod. And used that, remember that Hammer macro wide angle lens attachment I talked about a few weeks ago? I used that, but on a telephoto lens to see what it was like. It seemed to work okay. It was very tricky to focus, though. Very, very tricky indeed. And the depth of field was absolutely minute. So I had to close up the aperture to, like, I think, F16 or F22, something like that, to get a chance of getting anything in focus. But I made quite a nice little black and white, which I made grainy using Silver FX Pro from Nick Software, and that's on my Flickr stream. If you've had a look recently, you'll have to forgive me. I might pause the podcast quite a few times tonight because I've got a little bit of a cold in the sore throat. So I'm gulping on a nice hot cup of coffee and trying desperately not to sneeze. So, yeah. Right, so before we get started up, it's time to speak about our sponsor, which is GoToMeeting. So, being able to attach a face to a name is important. It enhances our relationships, the way we do business. But unfortunately, meeting all of your clients and colleagues in person can be impossible. That's why I recommend GoToMeeting with HD Faces. It lets you meet face to face from anywhere in the world. So with GoToMeeting by Citrix, it just takes a webcam and a click to collaborate in group high-definition video. You can see your attendees eye-to-eye while collaborating on documents in real time. You'll feel instantly connected, even if you're thousands of miles apart. Plus, GoToMeeting is so easy to set up and simple to use. So, I mean, I talk about this every week, don't I? Been on the receiving end and had to give lots of different conference calls in my career as a retail manager. And I can tell you, a lot of the time when you're just listening in, you're not really listening in. You tend to be planning your day, reading the newspaper, or playing around with your phone while your boss is on the other end telling you about sales targets and his ambitions for the day, the week, and the month, etc. But before we took on GoToMeeting with HD Faces as a sponsor, we got a chance to play around with it. There's like a big group of us from the Tech Podcast Network, and it was very impressive indeed, because not only can you see the conference call leader's computer screen, but you can see the faces of the people you're on the conference call as well. It makes it a lot more interactive and a lot more productive. So start hosting your own face-to-face online meetings today with GoToMeeting. You can try it free for 30 days. Don't wait. Go straight over there for this special offer. Visit GoToMeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button and use the promo code PODCAST. So, visit the URL gotomeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button and use the promo code PODCAST. Make sure you use that promo code. So, there's a few things I wanted to talk about this evening. The first one was an article I picked up on my RSS feed from, where's it from? Here, it's from the British Journal of Photography. And it's about an email that a picture editor who works at the Telegraph in the UK sent to somebody, a photographer, who they'd borrowed, I say borrowed, should really say stole, one of his photographs and used it, I think it was on their website, without his permission, and the ensuing kind of conversation they had. The Telegraph is a big newspaper, national newspaper in the UK. And this story kind of reflects the ongoing, the attack on photographers' rights. I mean, it's part of the digital problem we have, in the fact that the internet is a wonderful thing and it allows us to take our photography to new levels, but there's also a cost of it, especially to professionals. And a big part of this is the perceived value of photography and the conception that most people have is that photographs on the web, if they're on the web, they're free to use for whatever they like, especially if it doesn't have a copyright notice or things like that. So what happened was, this guy called Jonathan Kent noticed that his photograph had been used by the Daily Mail online website and also by the Telegraph website without his permission. And so they'd got his photograph from somewhere, I think it was from his blog, and just used it on their website. Now, the Mail Online paid him some money to recompense him, if you like. And the Daily Telegraph kind of did the same thing, but they also got into this conversation that really sort of shone a light on the attitude of these professionals who work at a daily newspaper's website, what they think about photographs. Let me just read it out from you, and I'm reading from the article on BJP online. I'll put a link in the show notes, but if you do a search, well, actually, no, go to robinonphoto.com, find the show notes links for this podcast, and you'll see. So here we go. So, after the photographer requested to be paid for the unauthorised use, Matthew Fern, a deputy picture editor at the Telegraph, has been caught arguing that due to the nature of the industry, picture desks around the country are not always required to seek permission before publishing images. In an email seen by BJP, British Journal of Photography, Fern writes that due to the ever-shifting nature of news, in particular with the advent of online publishing, it is not always possible to secure copyright clearance before pictures are published. And he adds, our industry therefore adopts a stance that if a picture has no overwhelming artistic value and there is no issue of exclusivity, i.e. it's already been published online or elsewhere, then no reasonable copyright owner will object to its being republished in exchange for a reasonable license fee. The only alternative to such a stance is not to publish pictures at all, unless they come from a commercial library, the available range of which inevitably be inadequate. The picture editor then goes on to point out that if Kent were to pursue a legal case against the newspaper, it would result in his blacklisting. Clearly, it is open to the copyright owner to adopt the position that we have violated their copyright. The legal position in cases of breach of copyright is generally that the publisher is required to pay double the industry rate to take account of any flagrancy of the breach. Inevitably, the outcome is that publishers tend to not use pictures from such copyright owners in the future. Fern then blames the blunder on the photographer, arguing that if his blog had had contact details, the Telegraph would have been more than willing to pay the appropriate fee. In this instance, and in the light of what you've told us, we have no reason to doubt that you are the copyright owner of this picture. However, the blog from which it was taken gave no indication as to the copyright owner and no contact details. We therefore used it. And in fact, we inadvertently used it again for some 4 hours this morning in the normal way, which is to say that we were always prepared to pay the industry standard rate. Fern has proposed to settle the case by a payment of £400, while denying flagrancy, adding that Kent had better accept the offer as he would not get a better deal in court. Alright, okay, so, and there's an update as well on there as well, which says that a Telegraph spokeswoman has issued the following statement to the British Journal of Photography. The Telegraph addressed swiftly and openly the legitimate concerns of a professional photographer. We told him that the industry rate for online usage of a picture such as this is £25. Having been unable to secure clearance in advance, as we do in 99% of cases, we were always prepared to pay substantially more to compensate him for any inconvenience. As soon as he contacted us, we explained the circumstances and offered him 8 times the industry rate. In seeking £1,000 from us, Mr. Kent made clear that he had copied his email to the BJP and that he would likely to take an interest in this matter if we did not pay him. So gosh! So this isn't some mom and pop website taking a photograph of somebody's blog and just using it. This is the Telegraph. This is a major UK newspaper. So these are professional. These are people who deal with photographers and photographs and image rights every day. And yet their attitude is that they'll take something and use it without asking permission first. And beyond a cursory attempt to contact people, the only way that you would get paid if they took one of your photographs, if you spotted the fact that they'd used it and then emailed them and said, look, that's my photograph, you've got no right to use it. And they would say, okay, well, we'll pay you some money then. And by the way, don't take us to court for breach of copyright, because if you do, we'll never use any of your photographs again. It's an absolutely amazing attitude to have. You'd have thought that, especially things like newspapers, would be defending the rights of photographers and copyright things like that, because they wouldn't like it if we took their text and reproduced that somewhere else. It just really astounds me, and it kind of speaks to me to really make me start to think about defending, you know, my photograph as well, because although my images now aren't under Creative Commons like they used to be. Creative Commons is different to copyright in that with Creative Commons you say, look, you can use my photograph as long as you give me some credit for it. A link is the normal thing. But don't muck around with it and don't make money out of it. But I've since changed and I don't do that anymore. They're all copyrighted. So if somebody wants to use my photograph, they've got to ask my permission. I might let it, or I might sort of say, well, no, you know, give me some money. But the problem with this instance is that you've now got a situation where institutions will use photographs without asking your permission. And then the only way you'll get money out of them is to discover it, which you might never do, and then demand money out of it. So I'm really starting to think about, do I start plastering copyright notices on my photographs, you know, before I put them up? Because I used to do that as well, but I felt it kind of spoiled anybody's enjoyment of the photograph. You want to look at it big. You know, you don't want like Rodman Photocom or copyright Rodman stamped all over it. So, you know, one of the dreams we all have is of getting paid for our photographs, isn't it? Because then it, you know, pays for more kit or days out or petrol for the car or Christmas presents for the kids. And yet this action by this supposedly reputable newspaper makes you think, well, you've got to defend your creative content, haven't you, by plastering with copyright images so they can't do it. You know, it isn't just people who would never pay for your photographs who are stealing photographs. It's the people who should be paying for the photographs are stealing them too. So I don't know, what are your thoughts? Send me emails, scalespeeder@gmail.com, and maybe we'll have a follow-up to this particular issue with what other people. You know, am I worried about nothing, or is this a really sad indictment of supposedly professionals coming up with a definitely unprofessional attitude to photos and photographers' rights? Okay, so there we go. Down off my pedestal, down off my podium for my little rant there. Time for our final sponsor of the night, which is Mosey for Business. When it comes to running a successful business, there are many things you have to get right, like hiring good people. One thing that's often overlooked, and that's protecting the data that powers your business. Did you know that 12,000 laptops are lost or stolen at airports every single week? It's amazing, isn't it? 50% of businesses that find themselves without data management for 10 days or more file for bankruptcy. I want to tell you about our friends at Mosey, the most trusted name in online backup. They back up more data than the entire written works of mankind from the beginning of recorded history in all languages. Companies like General Electric, Starwood Hotels and Accenture use MozyPro to back up their data. MozyPro also backs up educational institutions like Stanford University and the Yale School of Management. If you're not backing up your business data with MozyPro, here's a reason you should consider MozyPro to back up your business data. MozyPro works on both PCs and Macs, and it's great for backing up servers too. If your business is not backed up with MozyPro, you really need to make sure your data is backed up. Give our friends at Mozy a call. They've been doing this a long time and run the most secure, most trusted online backup service. Right now, you can save 15% by using the promo code PODCAST50. So in the States, call 877-669-9776. That's 877-669-9776 or visit mozypro.com. That's mozypro.com. Thanks for sponsoring the SEL Photography Podcast. Now, on to something a little bit more positive, and that's the World Press Photo competition, which has just finished. He says, clicking on the right link. There we are. Well, World Press Photo winner 2011. You may well have seen this if you subscribe, but a Spanish photographer called Samuel Aranda has won the 2011 World Press Photo for his photo of... It's a veiled woman in, like, traditional Muslim dress cradling a wounded man that was taken after a demonstration in the Yemen, part of the Arab Spring that happened last year. And what I thought I'd like to do is just talk about some of these photos. it's weird, isn't it, talking about photographs in an internet radio show. It shouldn't really work. Maybe it doesn't, but bear with me. If you want to kind of look along, I'll put the link in the show notes to the little slideshow on the BBC website, so you can go through these images. There are a selection of the winning photograph and some of the others as well. There's dozens and dozens if you go to the official World Press Photo site. If you're on your computer now, though, and can't get to the link, if you just do a search for BBC and then World Press Photo 2011, you should come up with the slideshow anyway. The World Press Photo is a foundation that's a non-profit making, and it's run from the Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and it was founded in 1955. And they strive to generate worldwide public interest in an appreciation for the work of photographers and for the free exchange of information. Their activities include organising an annual contest, exhibitions, the stimulation of photojournalism through education programmes, and creating greater visibility for press photography through a variety of publications. So it's brilliant. You know, you'll see these fantastic images. They're free to look at. And it's kind of, you know, while you've got organisations such as this bringing photography on, supporting photographers, then you've got organisations like the Telegraph sort of stealing photographs. But I'm not going to talk about that anymore. Let's have a look at the first image. So the first image is that winning photograph. And a lot of these photographs are all about strong subjects. You know, these are, I guess, professional photojournalists in challenging situations. You know, it's all about the moment and being there. The second photograph, taken by Yuri Kozarev of Russia, won the first prize in the Spot News singles category, and it's a picture of the rebels in Libya, and it looks like they're on some sort of mounted machine gun, and maybe some shells coming in, and they're running for their lives. So this guy was there on the front line risking his life, and several journalists did die in the Libyan conflict, and that you can't get much more of the moment than that. Then there's this great sports photography shot by Ray McManus from Ireland, who won second prize for Sports Signals singles, which is a picture from a rugby match between Old Belvedere and Blackrock. And it's, again, it's a picture of a rugby, if you know, like a rugby mall, when everybody sort of comes together. You kind of, if you've watched rugby, if you're not from the British Isles or France or Australia, what happens is men running around, a bit like American football, kind of, but the game doesn't stop. When you have a tackle situation, when one player tackles another, it kind of get all the players kind of smash into each other, and the ball kind of pops out the back, and someone like the scrum half picks it up and then throws it. And it's this moment where the ball's just been picked up, But what adds to the photo is that there's rain pouring down. The players, they all look like they're on the same team. They're all covered in black mud. You can see, you know, the steam coming off the players as well. There's one guy with the ball. There's another guy hanging onto somebody's leg. There's a few players looking on. And it really is a fantastic sports photograph. There's this, I had to look twice at this one. This is by Demir Sagolj. He or she won first prize in the Daily Life singles with a photograph of a picture of North Korea's founder decorating a building in the capital, Pyongyang. So this is a photograph kind of looking down on a lots of flats, lots of, I guess they're like a domestic area, living area, lots of all these sort of grey, look like communist flats, which they are. And then if you look very, very carefully, they're all very flat colours. Look very carefully, right at the bottom of the middle, there's a tiny portrait of Kim Il-sung lit up. So it's all shining, almost like a religious icon amid all this grey. And it kind of speaks volumes about the situation in North Korea. And then we've got a really challenging photograph by a guy called Brent Sturton from South Africa. And he won first prize for the contemporary issue single with a picture of Maria, who's a drug addict and a sex worker. You can't quite imagine the level of trust that the photographer had to build up with this person to enable him to take this picture, because you can't imagine them saying, come and take a picture, because he's a very sorry individual indeed. Looks, to look at, you feel very sorry for her. You look at the photograph and make your own decision. I'll skip past that one. Here's another classic one. Vincent Bossoir of France, a repressed photographer, has won second prize in the arts and entertainment singles with a picture of a model posing in front of the tailor stalls. And again, this is a great shot. Somebody out and about, wandering around, this time in Dakar, in Senegal, and got the camera. There's a great moment with this person looking straight at the camera while everybody else is getting on with their jobs. Lots of colour, lots of movement, and another great moment. And there's a couple of photographs in here that are sort of the aftermath of the tsunami in Japan, and these are kind of where, the images speak to themselves. But another photograph that took my eye was one by Jenny E. Ross of the US, who she won the first prize in the nature singles part, and it's a picture of a male polar bear climbing on the face of a cliff. And then you kind of look closely, and you realise it's a cliff. Then you realise there's all these penguins on the cliff as well, and they're all kind of looking at this big hungry polar bear, kind of thinking, "Oh gosh, we're going to be lunch. Maybe it's time to get out of the way." So a great photograph, very geometric in the lines and the waves coming across it. And again, it's putting yourself in these situations, isn't it? And another photograph here from Alex Maggioli of Italy. And this is from Tahrir Square in Cairo, in Egypt. And you look at this photo, and it almost looks like all these different faces who are shouting and crying and chanting. They look like they're all photoshopped together, but I don't think they are. It's all, it's one photograph, and it's very powerful, kind of encapsulating the feeling of the time with the Arab Spring and the revolution that happened in Egypt. And then we have Yasuyoshi Chiba of Japan. That person won first prize in the news stories with I'm getting that wrong. Yeah, aftermath of the tsunami. And this is an interesting photograph. It's a picture of a woman standing amid the rubble of the tsunami, and in her hand she's smiling, and she's holding up this what is a graduation certificate from her daughter. An important thing, amidst all this destruction, she's found something of their past, and the joy in her face. It's a great moment. It kind of speaks to how people are starting to rebuild their lives. And then we have a very sad photo from Niklas Hammerström, of Sweden. And it's a picture of some rocks next to some water with some clothes on. And this is this is that island in Norway where all those kids were killed back in July. Very powerful. Obviously, the kids took off their clothes and then tried to swim for their lives. And then we're back to the World Press Photo winner. So lots of inspiration there. I know it's a bit silly listening to me talk about it. Instead, head over to World Press Photo or the BBC slideshow and have a look at some of the images themselves and be inspired just as I will. I got an interesting question this week from Philip, who asked me about geotagging and whether is it worth doing, do I still do it, etc. Because many moons ago, I was very enthusiastic about geotagging. And you may well remember, I've still got these little geotagging devices that you carry around with you that log the time and place of where you are. And then when you get home, you plug the files into your computer, you run the software, and the software marries up where you've been from the little tagger, the little logger, to the photographs and puts the latitude and longitude with them. And it's great. However, because of a kind of a combination of having old slow PCs that would take ages for it to do, and lack of time, I kind of slipped out of the routine of doing it. But I've actually started geotagging my images again. But the way I do it now is actually with Picasa 3, the free photo editing and organizational software from Google. Because one of the things you can do with that is geotag your photos. But the disadvantage of it is that you have to know where you've been. So it's all about tagging them from the future and for other people when they look at them on Flickr, etc. And what you do with that is you just open up, your photos, if you open up Picasa, it scans your drive and your photos are there. And one of the panels you can use on the right hand side is the maps panel. And you can search for where you were and then you can put a pointer in and say, yeah, I took that photograph or these series of photographs there. And it automatically puts the latitude and longitude in. And I would say, yeah, go for it. If I was going on holiday, I probably would take one of my geotagging devices, actually, because by the time you get back, you wouldn't remember exactly where you were in particular places, or do as Philip does and use your phone to track the location. The only problem I could see with that would be that if you do go abroad with your phone, whether it will work without it having to access any data, because we all know that once you go abroad with a mobile phone, if it starts trying to log onto the internet and do things like that, it will start costing you a lot of money. So Philip, yeah, I do still use geotagging, and I think it's very important, especially for the future. You know, in 20, 30 years' time, if the digital images are still around, people can look at them and see exactly where they were taken on the Earth. So I think that's very good indeed. So as ever, if you've got any questions or queries or ideas for the podcast or the blog, please email me, scalespeeder@gmail.com. They give me inspiration for each episode, because after over 170, sometimes I do have to scratch my head a little bit and think, what am I going to talk about this week? And I don't want to bore everybody. I want this to be half an hour of your time well spent, where you come away and think, well, right, yeah, I think I'll go and fancy take some photographs now. Now, remember, over on the robnonphoto.com Flickr group, there's the photo assignment, which is winter where I live. We've still got the whole of February to carry on shooting for that one. There's some great work going in there already. Thanks very much for everybody getting involved in that. I'm going to put some photos in it this week, I think. And thanks, everybody, for commenting on the blog, taking part in the Flickr group, and, of course, for downloading and listening to the podcast. Thanks to Everyday Jones, who do the intro and outro for the podcast. You can find their music over on podsafeaudio.com. But once again, I'll say it, thanks to you for listening to me for the past half hour. My name's Rob from robnonphoto.com, and hopefully, pretty soon, I'll see you on Flickr.